Fama writes, as an Italian-American connected and adventuring into her heritage, and as a lesbian identifying with the unspoken passions of the past and also conveying the passions of her own life.
You get a wallet card to carry with your driver's license, and if you ever are hospitalized, they look at this card, they type numbers into the computer at the hospital, and they get the document right there on the screen, and there can't be any questions about who it is who's entitled to make medical decisions.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. The UN okays more queer consultants. Sappho's legacy lives in a Sicilian sister's poetry, and the difference between marriage rights and family protections. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 26, 2008. Two more LGBT groups have been given consultative status by the United Nations Economic and Social Council, or ECOSOC. COC Netherlands and the State Federation of Lesbians, Gays, Transsexuals, and Bisexuals of Spain will now be allowed, as non-governmental organizations or NGOs, to deliver oral and written reports at UN meetings and to organize events there. ECOSOC, consisting of 54 member states of the UN, grants consultative status after reviewing recommendations of its subsidiary body, the NGO Committee, which screens the applications. Among more than 3,000 such groups, only a handful of LGBT organizations have gained consultative status, often after the full ECOSOC overturned negative recommendations from its NGO committee, which is typically dominated by member countries hostile to LGBT rights. In recent years, ECOSOC has approved Danish, German, and Swedish LGBT organizations for consultative status, along with a group from the Canadian province of Quebec and the European branch of the International Lesbian and Gay Association. The U.S.-based International Wages Due Lesbians and the Australian-based Coalition of Activist Lesbians have each had consultative status at the UN for more than a decade. The NGO committee is scheduled to review several additional applications from LGBT groups at its next two sessions in January and May 2009.
Some 5,000 athletes from across Europe converged on Barcelona this week for the annual Eurogames, which were first held in 1992 in the Dutch capital of The Hague. More than 30,000 tourists were expected to attend the Olympic-style sporting event in the Spanish port city, which is open to competitors of all sexual orientations and gender identities. Organizers say it could boost the local economy by up to 30 million euros, almost 48 million U.S. dollars. The four-day event kicked off on July 24th in colorful opening ceremonies at the Palau Sant Jordi Indoor Sporting Arena, which also hosted events during the 1992 Summer Olympic Games. Athletes are competing in several venues around Barcelona in 28 different sports, including tennis, swimming, track and field, and basketball. But same-gender versions of ballroom dancing are also a competitive sport. Queer conferences and cultural events are also being held in conjunction with the sports competitions.
More than 120,000 people turned out for Vienna's 13th LGBT Pride Parade on July 12th. Organizers called for an end to discrimination in Austria and for marriage equality.
But an attorney for the family of a California gay man who died after being shot by police during an LGBT pride-related boat cruise in San Diego Harbor is planning to file state and federal civil rights lawsuits. Brian Claypool said the suits will accuse San Diego Harbor police and the two officers involved of excessive force, negligence, and civil rights violations. Harbor police were alerted by operators of the charter boat late in the evening on July 19th that a man had gone overboard. 37-year-old Stephen Paul Hirschfield of West Hollywood was rescued, but reportedly began fighting with officers. He allegedly grabbed a taser from one officer and hit him in the face, and then, police officials said, Hirschfield attempted to take the officer's handgun. As the two struggled, a second officer shot Hirschfield. He was pronounced dead by paramedics when the police boat docked. But family attorney Claypool said that autopsy results showed no evidence on Hirschfield's body that he had struggled with police prior to being shot and that he was not the aggressor. The way the officers handled the situation, he said, is consistent with individuals who have a bias or prejudice against gay people. A spokesperson for the Harbor Police said the department had no comment because it had not yet seen details of the lawsuit.
A judge ruled this week that 14-year-old Brandon McInerney, who's charged with the hate crime murder in February of 15-year-old fellow student Larry King in an Oxnard, California classroom, will be tried as an adult. He faces 50 years to life in prison. Several classmates have said King would wear feminine attire, sometimes flirting with and angering other boys at the school. He was shot in the head during a morning computer class. More than 20 other students were in the room at the time. McInerney was arrested shortly thereafter. His attorney fought to have the teen tried as a juvenile. A conviction in juvenile court would have allowed him to go free at age 25. A coalition of 27 LGBT rights groups had sided with McInerney's lawyer and called on the district attorney not to prosecute McInerney as an adult. But he will be formally arraigned as an adult on August 7th.
26-year-old physics student Ahmet Yildiz, dubbed Turkey's gay poster boy after he attended an international LGBT event in San Francisco last year, was shot to death late last week as he was leaving a cafe in Istanbul. He tried to escape his attackers in his car, but lost control, crashed at the side of the road, and died shortly afterwards in the hospital. Friends told reporters that he was a victim of Turkey's first gay honor killing. Women have until now been the only known victims of such murders, usually by male relatives, for offending chauvinistic conservative social traditions, so Yildiz's case may be unique. Friends speculate that he was targeted after coming out as a gay man earlier this year. "I never heard Ahmet have a friendly conversation with his parents," one close friend and neighbor told the London Independent newspaper. "They would argue constantly, mostly about where he was, who he was with, and what he was doing," he said. "They wanted him to see a doctor who could cure him and get married." Yildiz reportedly told a prosecutor 5 months ago that he had been receiving death threats, but no action was taken. His boyfriend, who held a German passport, left the country soon after the shooting on the advice of the consulate. Police claimed to be investigating the case. "He could have hidden who he was, but he wanted to live honestly," another friend told the newspaper. "When the death threat started, his boyfriend tried to persuade him to get out of Turkey, but he stayed. He was too brave."
Thousands of LGBT activists from across Australia protested Roman Catholic Pope Benedict XVI's visit to the country this week. He'd been in Australia as part of World Youth Day, a mass gathering of adherents aimed at encouraging them to celebrate their faith. As pilgrims marched from Anzac Parade and Moore Park Road in Sydney on July 20th, thousands of protesters handed out condoms and waved placards along the route with slogans like "Pope, go homo." It was mostly peaceful, although a Catholic man was arrested for allegedly punching one of the protesters. He was later released without charge. New South Wales police officials had originally banned protesters from attending World Youth Day events under the pretense that it was illegal to annoy the pilgrims. The Australian federal court rejected that assertion. Pope Benedict has since returned to Rome.
A U.S. House panel on July 23rd heard from five witnesses in the first-ever congressional hearing to consider the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The measure banning open gays and lesbians in the armed forces was adopted early in the Clinton administration. Three of those testifying advocated repeal of the policy, but two others charged that Don't Ask, Don't Tell wasn't strong enough to prevent gays and lesbians from enlisting. Captain Joan E. Dara, a retired naval intelligence officer who served for 29 years, and Staff Sergeant Eric Alva, a retired Marine who lost his leg as the first American injury of the Iraq War, testified about how the policy prevents qualified personnel from serving their country. Retired heterosexual Major General Vance Coleman, an African-American who joined the Army in 1947, 1 year before President Harry Truman desegregated the military, also told the panel that, "I know what it's like to be treated like a second-class citizen." But Elaine Donnelly, president of the Center for Military Readiness, testified with what Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank described as an extraordinary exhibition of rage. She claimed that lesbians would take pictures of other servicewomen while they were showering, warned of forcible sodomy, that gay men would spread HIV positivity through the ranks, and that repealing the policy would allow personnel to cross-dress. A member of the House panel, Democratic Representative Vic Snyder of Arkansas, called her statements just bonkers and dumb. Sergeant Major Brian Jones, a retired Army officer, warned that cramped wartime conditions often require skin-to-skin contact when soldiers must huddle to protect themselves from cold, a situation he argued in which arousal would be disastrous. While those testifying against repeal seemed to generate more support in the committee for overturning Don't Ask, Don't Tell, most analysts say there's little chance that a congressional vote will come this year and that President Bush would likely veto a repeal measure if it passed.
And finally, a court in Athens has rejected a lawsuit spearheaded by a male resident of Lesbos demanding that the term lesbian should only be legal to describe those who live on the Greek island. The plaintiffs argued that Lesbos residents held sole claim to the word and that its use in the context of female sexuality disgraced them around the world. The suit also claimed that the name of the national LGBT group Homosexual and Lesbian Community of Greece insults the identity of the people of Lesbos. The island is a popular holiday destination, especially for lesbians, because it was home to the ancient poet Sappho, who passionately wrote about love between women. Several residents testified during the trial, in fact, that the use of the word lesbian had brought recognition to the island and boosted its tourist economy. The ruling not only threw out the lawsuit, the plaintiffs were also ordered to pay court costs. They told reporters, however, that they're considering an appeal.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 26, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Lee Moore.
And I'm John Beaupre.
Coming up later in the program, we'll hear about one woman who uncovered the true nature of little-known cultures, and we'll hear from another woman who uncovers false assumptions about contemporary families. But first... Her celebration of Italian-American and lesbian identity, Looking for Cover, poems by Maria Fama, includes a new look at an old favorite, Sappho. Fama explores the Sicilian roots of the poetess in exile. This Way Out correspondent Janet Mason explores the explorer.
To read Maria Fama's poetry is to enter another world that is wrought in lush and sensuous detail. You will find a rich history filled with the common folk, the peasants, who have come to this country from Italy, where they struggled and dreamed, and in passing down the stories of their lives and hardship, they have made the writer, and by extension the reader, stronger and more appreciative of life's simple pleasures. Her most recent collection of poetry, Looking for Covers, poems by Maria Fama, published by Bordighera Press in New York, is a study in identity. Fama writes, as an Italian-American connected and adventuring into her heritage, as a woman identifying the strengths often overlooked but inherent in the conventions and confinement of the lives of previous generations of women, and as a lesbian identifying with the unspoken passions of the past and also conveying the passions of her own life. Fama writes from these identities and of these identities from the subterranean fields of richly textured experience and not from labels. In some respects, the writing is ahead of its time, but also it is of its time and timeless. In this collection, we meet the camari, the Italian word for a special bond between women that went beyond friends. One of these camari, defined by Fama's wordplay as co-Marys and co-Marias, is Fama's aunt, Zia Angelina. Angelina and her special friend, her camari, live two doors away from each other. Camare Angelina, Camare Maria, late afternoons they sipped and dipped, they sipped espresso, they dipped biscotti. In the late afternoon they sipped and dipped before the suppers and the husbands filled their homes. The Tucumari mark their birthdays together, their name days, and Angelina searches the stores of South Philadelphia for the card that contains the sentiment that she has for her Camari. She searched high and low and was unable to find anything, so she bought a To My Husband card. She took the card home and with a black pen crossed out the word husband and wrote Camari. To my dear Camari. The words all fit. They fit. She knew they fit. She knew they fit her. Camari, 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 Maria. Angelina's Camari, Maria. The poem, Camari, is from the section of the book called Under the Tent, Performance Poems, some of which are recorded in Maria's voice on a companion CD. This section also contains Fama's piece entitled simply Sappho. In this exploration of the great lesbian poetess, whose Greek name is invoked, Sappho, Fama sees her Italian grandmother's face on the face of a young, beautiful Greek woman dancing at the festival. She takes this experience and launches it into a journey of her connection, as a woman who loves women and as a woman whose line of descent can be traced back to Sicily, the place where the poetess Sappho once lived in exile. She writes of the connection between Greece and Italy, between her own history and Sappho's, and the Sicilian and Greek saying, one face, one race, in Italian, una faccia, una razza. Greek and Sicilian, Tyrrhenian, Ionian, Aegean seas, the deepest blue, black eyes and green seas, sapphire, sapphic seas. This collection is peopled with the living and the dead, the loved ones and ancestors that she keeps alive in her memories, writing, and conversations with friends. From the Camari to the Sicilian understanding of Sappho to the ancestors and loved ones who have passed, Fama invokes her culture in richly textured writing full of sensuous details, allowing us, as readers, to enter this subterranean world where everything is honored. And in experiencing and understanding this, we learn to honor ourselves just a little bit more. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer literature and life for This Way Out.
Margaret Mead, prominent American anthropologist, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Margaret Mead was born in Philadelphia in 1901. Entering adulthood, she felt urged to advance the understanding of human behavior. Studying anthropology at Barnard College, she met her mentor, Ruth Benedict. Their relationship would become the most intimate of Mead's life, lasting throughout her three marriages. Mead's field study in the South Pacific led to her bestseller, Coming of Age in Samoa. Her research of various cultures made her one of the first in the modern age to champion diversity. In a 1975 article for Red Book magazine, she asserted it was time to recognize bisexuality as a normal form of sexual expression. She feared that revealing her own bisexuality would close doors in her career. But she said everyone should be able to choose companionship with a member of their own or opposite sex, which certainly opened doors for the next generation. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Candace Kimbrick.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. Support your local public radio station. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
The law has changed so that we have gender equality in marriage under the law. And I think that makes a lot of people think that the problems have been solved when, of course, they haven't been.
Last time on This Way Out, law professor Nancy Polakoff explained why she believes marriage equality is not the be-all and end-all of family rights. In this week's conclusion, correspondents Josie Cotoggio and Melissa Chiprin ask the author of Beyond Straight and Gay Marriage, Valuing All Families Under the Law, about one particular case that crystallized the issue.
I wanted to talk about Sharon Kowalski.
I start the book with her because certainly all of us who lived through that remember it very clearly. So Sharon Kowalski was very severely injured in a car accident. She had a partner of 4 years, Karen Thompson. They were not out to Sharon's family. Really, they weren't out to very many people. And Karen arrives at the hospital, isn't allowed to see Sharon. That's the beginning of 10 years of struggle over who's going to control Sharon's welfare. And for most of that time, Sharon's father was her guardian. Karen, at one point, it was 3.5 years that Karen couldn't even visit Sharon or see her. It was a complete tragedy and disgrace. Sharon's care deteriorated greatly.
I mean, her parents put her in a place where she was not getting rehabilitative
exactly.
care, even though she had indicated that she wanted her partner to be her caretaker.
Well, and that's why disability rights groups were also very involved in this case, because Sharon did have some ability to express what she wanted, and a series of judges just continually disregarded that on the theory that it wasn't reliable because of her disability. So there was quite a lot of political effort, but meanwhile, she did deteriorate. Now, ultimately, Karen did become her guardian. Karen was in a new relationship at that time, but she and her new partner brought Sharon back to their home, which Karen had completely fitted for Sharon's wheelchair, and the three of them continued to live together. Today, a family constellation that I think really challenges a lot of people's ideas about what a family is. That's why I argue so much that the law shouldn't be making these arbitrary limits. I mean, those three people do form a family together. And in order to keep those kinds of problems from happening, and I would also say I'm quite sympathetic to the same-sex couples who say they want to marry because they're terrified of what will happen if one of them's hospitalized.
My lover and I just had papers drawn up. I mean, that's what one does. You know, you do medical and legal powers of attorney.
Yes, you do that. But, you know, there are even examples of hospitals that have not honored those. And the answer is not marriage. I mean, that is so the wrong answer. First of all, one of the things I most surprised people with in the book is a study in Detroit of older married couples that showed that 50% of them didn't pick their spouses to be their medical power of attorney, so when they made them. So, you know, not everybody wants a spouse to do it. We need to make sure we have a way of facilitating what you and your partner did without having to go to lawyers. And there are actually states that do that very easily now. And I use Idaho as an example. There are some others. But, you know, people I know in Idaho who've gone to their primary care doctors, they actually get a little pamphlet saying, you know, fill out these forms, send them in to the Secretary of State's office. It goes into a database. You get a wallet card to carry with your driver's license. And if you ever are hospitalized, they look at this card. They type numbers into the computer at the hospital, and they get the document right there on the screen. And there can't be any questions about who it is who's entitled to make medical decisions. I'm hopeful that if enough states do this, we could get a national registry for these advanced healthcare directives, and it could become as easy as organ donation, or maybe even easier than organ donation, as a routine matter with no charge whatsoever for everybody to make clear who they want to make these decisions for them. Because you may have a partner, and the two of you may do this, but what about our single friends? They don't have a partner to do it with jointly, and certainly, of course, marriage is not anywhere near what's going to help them, but they should be equally entitled to make sure that their wishes about who makes decisions for them are recognized. So this is a very bad fit, the argument that we need to have marriage in order for same-sex couples to be able to have these medical protections. And so I do describe in the book the other ways to do it and the states that get it right. And really how silly the argument is, because unless those couples, even if they can marry, even if they're in Massachusetts, if they're never going to leave the state of Massachusetts, maybe they'll be okay. But if they travel outside the state, we've got more than half the states in this country that have constitutional amendments that ban same-sex marriage. I want everybody in those states to make sure the person they want makes their health care decisions. And I think we can accomplish this, because if you take it out of the context of same-sex marriage, there's really universal agreement that you and I and everybody else should get to pick the person who makes those decisions. And we can bypass the politics of same-sex marriage and get this problem solved for everybody.
Nancy, this is Melissa. I wanted to go back to something you said earlier. Is there a time frame when you say, like, a couple would get the legal rights that, say, that a married couple have?
Well, in Canada, They actually do, for most things, have a time frame. Some of them involve living together for a year, and others involve living together for 3 years. And some of their court cases show that living together is a little bit loose, like you could actually have two homes and still be living together under some factual circumstances. So there is a time frame for some of these rights to kick in. But if you think about it, perhaps some of those rights, even for people who marry, where you have marriage, should take a while to kick in. New Zealand actually has a law where if they don't have children, when they're married for less than 3 years, when they get divorced, each person just takes their own stuff and goes away. Like, they don't have the whole regime of property division in marriage until after they've been married for 3 years. So, you know, that's a good example of how instantly when you marry, nothing's really changed in your life except that piece of paper. And instantly you're entitled to inherit, for example, from the other person. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that you can't disinherit your spouse, but you can disinherit your children. Like, how shocking is that? That if you've got some children with a former spouse, you can leave them absolutely nothing in your will, period. But your new spouse, that person you can't disinherit. I mean, it's completely backwards. Anyway, for some of the things that I talk about in the book, I think a durational requirement makes a certain amount of sense. But for other things, you know, you're just really looking at how the people function together. And duration may not have anything to do with that. Washington State right now will divide the property of a couple that lives together, married or unmarried, in the same exact way. And so they don't use a durational time, but, you know, if you're only married for a year, there's not going to be much community property to divide. And if you're only living together for a year, the same thing. There's not going to be much community property to divide. But Washington State is the one place in this country now where if you live your life as an intimate family unit and you separate, they don't care whether you got married or not.
We've been talking with Nancy Polakoff about her book, Beyond Straight and Gay Marriage, Valuing All Families Under the Law, published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much, Nancy.
Thanks so much. It's been great talking to you.
And our thanks to This Way Out correspondents Josie Catoggio and Melissa Chiprin. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Lee Moore, John Beaupre, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Candace Gingrich, and Josie Catoggio and Martha Chiprin contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to help keep us on the air. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive weekly email alerts describing the content of each This Way Out, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KSOW Cottage Grove, Oregon, 2HOT Cobar, New South Wales, WOJB Hayward, Wisconsin, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. We're all going to stay tuned.